All right, everybody, welcome back. For those of you just joining us for the first time, you are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast, and I should begin by telling you that my name is Colin. I am joined, as I always am, by Dom. And joining us today as a guest is no one, which means more of us, which I think, you know, it's good to get back to just the two of us for a little bit. So today what we're going to be doing is going over the second episode of Survivor One World, and then after that we're going to talk a little bit about the season premiere of The Amazing Race. So coming into this episode of Survivor, we've just lost Courtney, and Alicia seems to be running the women's camp, and Colton is kind of on the outs within the men's tribe, and he's got an idol in his pocket, just so we all remember where we're at. The first confessional we see is Kat, and we'll definitely be getting to her a lot in a little bit, because she was a very big focal point for this episode. But before we get into Kat, just right after the females get back from Tribal Council, we see Christina trying to patch things up with Alicia after their little blowout at Tribal Council. What do you think about that, Tom?
I think both of them behaved as you'd expect them to. Christina was pretty rational and Alicia wasn't, to put it mildly. Like I said last week, I'm not sure if this will happen, but I think it'd be pretty sensible for everyone who's currently aligned with Alicia to kind of swap her out with Christina at some point. Thinking long term, that might not be a good idea, and we'll get to that in due course, but it's definitely something which Alicia herself is like putting in the minds of people, I'm sure.
That's probably true, and we've seen stuff like that, we've seen players like that throughout the course of Survivor history where they're just kind of grating to the point that even their alliance members are kind of like, we really made a mistake with this person. But nonetheless, Alicia seems to be the one, as I mentioned, kind of running the show at least at this point with the women's camp, and we see her, as we often see with the early kind of ringleader, get the confessional where she goes through and names all the people in the alliance, and then they cut real quickly to each of those people as she's naming them, which I thought was, I don't think we saw that when the guys were going over the weirdo alliance, which we'll also be getting to. But you see that a lot. I think we saw it last year with that alliance that ultimately made the final five. The editor's really beating it into our heads that, like, this is an alliance that looks like it's going to be together for a while.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting how it seemed like they went out of their way to make sure you remember that this is the five people who are making decisions. And if you look at that in the context of the whole episode, they were slammed pretty hard by the editors for keeping Kat, when in reality it was a pretty obvious and simple decision to make, I think. It suggests to me that they come a proper later somehow, and the editors are trying to retrospectively explain that by planting these seeds early on to make you think that they're incompetent or that you shouldn't be rooting for them.
Yeah, and we're actually going to be talking pretty in-depth about the edit after we're done kind of going through the episode itself. So stay tuned for that. And for those of you who are concerned or consider that spoilery or whatever, I assure you neither of us has any knowledge about any spoilers, and this is all just prognostication. And if I'm not even sure how much it's worth considering our track record in terms of being right about things, although this season I'm hoping we kind of turn the page. So, as a bit of a spoiler alert, we're ultimately going to see the women head to Tribal Council again, and because of that, this episode was almost entirely about the women's camp. Now, the first thing we really see the night after their Tribal Council is the next morning, the women are trying to get their camp life together, get their tribe spirit going, and to do that, they decide that they'd like to have a leader, which is something we haven't seen for a really long time. Now, Dom, the women, how do you feel like the women are doing this far? Thus far?
Okay. Well, as a tribe, as we've seen, the women are completely dysfunctional. Individually, we can say different things about each of them. Obviously, Alicia is putting herself in contention for worst of all time, which might be a bit hyperbolic, but she's definitely in the running. Kat, obviously, isn't making a very good name for herself. Chelsea is difficult to judge because we've seen she seems to have this kind of sub-alliance with Kim, which is pretty good. She seems respected by her group. Seems relatively well-liked, good in challenges, so doing okay so far. But Kim and Sabrina seem to be playing very good games, and with Kim in particular, I worry that she might be experiencing what you might call the Andrea effect, where her fans kind of overstate her potential achievements before she's even had a chance to make them. But right now, she does seem to be in a very good spot. And similarly with Sabrina, she's been elected leader, which historically hasn't been a good thing, but I don't think this is a case of people anointing her as a leader to try and tear her down. I think this is people expressing genuine confidence in her.
I agree, but I also think that ultimately that could be a very disastrous thing for her because as we've predicted several times on this show, and as I am willing to bet quite a bit on, we're going to see a tribe swap. And if the guys get word that Sabrina's the de facto women's leader, and they want to maintain tribe loyalty and try to take the numbers post-merge, they're probably going to, the women leader is probably going to be their biggest target, and that's going to be Sabrina as far as they know, and that's going to be the reality of the situation as well, considering she's completely owning the leadership title. And, you know, I also have high hopes for Sabrina, and I think, and we'll be getting to her certainly later when we talk about the editing, but I wasn't really a fan of her being so willing to be the leader.
I'm not so sure about that, actually. Thinking a few episodes ahead, so if you say that if there is a swap, it might take place maybe after the next two boots have occurred, so in episode 5. If you think about what might have happened by then, either the women... So there have been two tribal councils. Either the women have gone to both of them, the men have gone to both of them, or it's been mixed. Currently, in the men's tribe, we know that there's this divide down the middle between the frat boys and the outsiders. And conceivably, if Sabrina is put onto a tribe with a mixture of those two groups, so, say, like, Mike and Bill and Jonas or whoever, that divide is still going to be there, and she's going to be in a good position to exploit that. The worry would be, say, if the women start winning, and they go into tribe swap, and suddenly people like Monica or Christina see a chance to defect and maybe try and build a new alliance with some of the guys to rally against Sabrina's alliance. So, in a sense, it might actually work out better for her if the women continue losing. Obviously, that's not what she should be hoping to happen, but the fact that there could be a swap, you know, makes the dynamics a lot more interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And this season, I think, when we do see that swap, you're going to hear us talk a lot about variance, and this is going to be a high variance season, any season with a swap, because there are going to be either you can end up with a good swap or a bad swap.
Right, but as we said in our preview podcast, the format of the season, the one world twist, will ensure we think that the swap will lead to less variance, because now it's you're not just being stranded on a tribe with a bunch of new people who you haven't got a chance to know yet. You already have an idea of what's going on and who everyone is aligned with and so on. So if you're a good player, you're less likely to be randomly screwed over by a swap.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I think, one of the main criteria for being a good player is that less vulnerable to the luck factor. You leave yourself more outs. And just to reiterate, I think the one-world format definitely leads to a lower variance game, generally speaking. But just a swap, of course, is going to when it's completely random, is going to change is certainly a high variance situation.
Right, and the speculation about whether there'll be a swap leads me to believe that the outsiders on the men's side are currently in the best position because, by definition, they're the outsiders. They're not the big targets that you see in the form of some of the frat boys. So even if they're in a minority or in a nominal minority come the time of the swap, they're not going to be targeted early. So people who are well-positioned within that minority, someone like Jonas, for instance, I think is in a fantastic position right now because we've seen Colton has kind of banded these misfits together against the frat boys. So if things stay as they are, he's in a good spot. If things get switched up, he's almost certainly going to be in a good spot. He's not going to be targeted soon. He seems to get on well with everybody, you know. If you had to put money on one person winning the game right now, I think it would be Jonas.
Yeah. Jonas, I think, has had an excellent showing through the first two episodes, both with his position within the tribe, how he's going to be able to do in a lot of different permutations and swaps, and also with the edit that we've seen him get. And we'll be getting to that. And I think for now, though, let's go back to the women's camp briefly. And the first thing we really see Sabrina do as a leader is assign people all these different roles, and you know Monica says I'll be on water all the time. I'll keep all the thermoses or canteens full, and everyone's getting their own little tasks. And this is where we see Kat and Alicia, I think, as her partner to be firewood or whatever. And this is where we see Kat. I couldn't help but have flashbacks to a certain winter edit coupled with her opening confessional. Any guesses, Dom?
If you want to compare Kat to arguably the worst winner of all time, then you know. Be my guest, but I don't think that's a bad comparison, even though...
Who might that be?
A certain Fabio, as he's known.
Now, this is an interesting situation. I bring up Fabio, so I can bring this up. Dumb. Say the word Fabio.
But this is arguably racist, but okay. Fabio.
Now say, listen to this. This is going to blow your mind, listeners, because I've heard him say this before. Say the word Sandra. She's won the show twice. Say her name.
Look, I've got on this podcast. I can edit this out if I want to.
Listen. Now say the word... All right. Yeah, I just edit that out, because I was going to have you say cool with, but you...
just for you, Sandra.
Okay, oh, there we go. Perfect. Beautiful.
Sandra, as you...
Now say cool with. Sorry, alright, people at home are going to think that's hilarious. Alright, sorry. Okay.
They listen to it.
Yeah, if you decide to leave that in. So, okay. So the women are all getting their roles, and the next thing we really see is the reward challenge. Now, this is the second time we've seen, the first being in Samoa. This is a do-it-yourself reward challenge where the players run the challenge themselves, and Jeff Probst is nowhere to be found. He's off drinking in his little tent. That's just speculation on my part. I don't know what he's actually doing. What do you think about the do-it-yourself challenge?
I think budget cuts are showing themselves again. I don't know. I mean, in Samoa, it was a kind of a nice novelty just to see them show up and have no idea what's going on. I think it's the sort of thing that only works once. Once you see it again, and it's been suggested that we're going to see this a few more times this season, it just starts to become boring, I think. When you watch a challenge being played out without Jeff's narration, I think you realise just how much it actually does add to the challenge. Like, I know a lot of people dislike or make fun of Jeff's commentary and say, they pine for the days when Jeff was less involved with the show. But challenges without narration is just boring. It's hard to tell what's going on. Nothing's happening. It just doesn't really add much to the show without Jeff there.
In Samoa, I liked it because I thought it was a kind of cool novelty, and the players, you could really see them thinking on their feet, like, we have to be the ones that are running this. Now that we've already seen it, first of all, I didn't like it when it was at their own camp and when it's not some special location like Challenge Beach or whatever, where they all know the whole time that it's going to be them running it themselves. And I certainly don't like the prospect of seeing a lot of these over the course of the season. You know, I'm happy to see reward challenges return, but I would really like to see Jeff return with the reward challenges. I don't know that it was an issue in terms of Jeff kind of, not blackmailing Mark Burnett or whatever, but kind of holding out. I don't know that he was holding out to say, see how bad you need me for this, because, you know, he's only signed through one more year and has his big talk show coming up. So maybe he's looking for money. I don't know about that. There was some speculation about that. But I do want to talk about the reward challenge, a couple aspects of it, actually. The first being they were playing for a tarp. Now, I would assume for the most part that the rewards are planned out ahead of time, but I have to imagine that for these, they wouldn't have necessarily been planning out rewards that if everyone had decided to live in one tribe, it would render all of the rewards moot.
Right. I believe what they do is they plan out all the challenges ahead of time, but they switch around the order depending on what happens. So not to say that they're rigging it for certain contestants or whatever, but let's say something happens which means that one challenge can't go ahead, they might swap that in 2 weeks later or whatever.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Again, I don't know that much about production, but I have to imagine that had they chosen to live together, they probably wouldn't be offering them nothing but rewards that they could just split.
Because if they had chosen to live together, both of them would have had to use for the top, so they wouldn't actually be competing for anything. So maybe they would have replaced that with something else, I don't know. But even if they'd replaced it with food, for instance, if they had chosen to live together, then, again, they wouldn't really be competing for anything. So they were making a fairly big but possibly justifiable assumption that the camps would be naturally split across gender lines.
Yeah, I wasn't so willing to make that. I was really hoping that we would get to see two tribes kind of living cohesively, a la Big Brother, where everyone has to be super friendly around the house, but then they're still picking each other off one at a time. I also thought it was interesting that I didn't hear anyone, myself absolutely included, who thought this through and said, you know, they're bringing reward challenges back, and when coupled with One World, the players could work this to just be able to just split all the rewards. Or just one other thing, I guess, about the reward challenge, which is we see the men, for whatever reason, decide to sit out Mike. Yet Colton, who is a challenge participant, is the one acting as Jeff Probst in terms of start survivors ready, and then he says set, because he's an idiot, and then says go. He's the one running that when he's also one of the people participating in the challenges and And as we saw, this was a pretty close challenge. So couple things about that. When they said Mike couldn't participate in any way in the challenge, I didn't know it was to that extent, because it seems like Mike would be the one that would naturally take over as Probst.
Or rather, Big Mike, as he's apparently.
Yeah, right. That's right. And then, just a quick note, I thought Sabrina had a confessional after the women lost the reward challenge, and this is the first winner quote alert of the season. Sabrina says, "No one ever remembers second place," as it fades out of the shot of some part of the ocean and cuts to black to go to commercial. One of the first potential winner quotes from one of the leading winner candidates. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I wouldn't call it a winner quote. I might call it a runner-up quote, if such a thing exists.
Yeah, that's the other thing I was thinking about. Definitely. When we talk about the edits, we're going to be talking, I think, specifically about Sabrina, Kim, and Jonas in terms of the leading, the front row.
Yeah. It's difficult for me to think about, though, because if you try to imagine what would need to happen for Sabrina to get second place specifically, mm-hmm. she seems fairly popular within her tribe, at least. So you have to imagine that if she's against most combinations of people, she would win. So it makes me think that either there's some kind of mixed gender final three in which one of the popular men wins, or you know, she goes to the end with like Kim and Chelsea or someone and just gets beat. Or she mistakenly takes Kim or Chelsea to the end and loses them.
And gets second. And that was the other thought I had. But it nevertheless, I thought, was maybe not a winner quote, but certainly a big quote that I think we're meant to remember. And we saw Coach have a lot of those who, I guess, coincidentally got second place last season. So the next thing we're going to see is back at men's camp. And this is one of the only things we see at men's camp. And this is Colton. And Colton, as Dom mentioned, we may get a little hyperbolic from time to time, throwing around greatest of all time and worst of all time. Colton, like Alicia, is legitimately in the running for the coveted worst of all time title. John, thoughts about Colton.
Right. I remember last season, after the first few episodes, people were saying similar things about Colton. They were saying he's terrible, everyone hates him, he's terrible at strategy, he's one of the worst of all time, he's a disgrace to supervillains and all of this stuff. I always thought that was kind of exaggerated, but if you take all of that and amplify it, it applies exactly to Colton. He is like the embodiment of everything that could go wrong for a player. And as a character, I find him to be eminently unlikable.
He's making zero effort to fit in with his tribe to the point that he goes over and begs the women if he can move in with them.
Right, and I'm saying this as someone who usually roots the villains. I like it when you have people like, Marty or Matt this season, as he looked to be, although he was completely invisible this episode, which I have no idea what's up with that. But I like rooting for the kind of slightly douchey negative characters, because usually you can tell that that's an act and they're not that bad in real life. Colton, I think, is that bad in real life.
I find it pretty easy to agree with that. And, we see, like Gary Wise mentioned, they make characters out to be black and white, and I'm sure Colton, not everything about Colton, I'm sure they're masking some of his more redeeming qualities, but the way he's playing Survivor is not indicative to me of someone who's a super fan, to the point that he just can't hide his own personal feelings for the sake of playing the game, and that's why I think I have him so far high on the list of worst of all time, and certainly has outs to get to the top of that list. Now, the question for you, when he asked the women to move in, Kim, I think it was Kim, correctly points out that whether he's intending to use this information maliciously or not, if they do, in fact, let him move in, he will still have a lot of their tribal information, which is something they can't let happen. Do you think there was any merit to letting Colton move in with them? Do you think there would be a way that they could use that to their advantage?
Honestly, I don't think there is. Colton, it seems, if the idea is that you want to get close to him so that he volunteers information, it seems like he's doing that already. And if Colton's spending too much time with the women, he's not going to be able to, for instance, set up an alliance with all the misfits over on the men's side. He's not going to be able to get a good read on someone like Jay or Bill, who might be under the radar or something. So if you do let him move in with you, he's not going to be able to provide you the sort of information that will be most useful. And he's less likely to be able to continue in the game, which you want him to do, since he clearly wants to be an ally of yours.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the women are right in doing everything in their power. If they find all the idols in the world, just keep handing them over to Colton, because he's made it quite clear he's going to go with them as soon as he possibly can. And I think speaking of Colton's idol, the next thing we see is him, somewhat surprisingly to me, although not, I saw the previews, I was surprised, just cut that out, I guess, somewhat surprisingly showing the idol to several people in the men's tribe, basically all those not in the frat boy alliance, so-called, those being, Leaf, Troizan, Jonas, and Tarzan. Colton shows them the idol and says, listen, I'm going to play this at the next tribal council. What do you think about that scene? That seems like a pretty big game changer.
Yeah, a very bold, aggressive play by Colton, although I think it's necessary because he knows his back's up against the wall, which he is to blame for. Let's not make any excuses for him. But yeah, it is a good move to further his short-term goals. I like it.
Yeah, actually, you know, I was surprised. You know, we just gotten done talking about him being the worst of all time, and that's more just he's putting himself in such a position that he can never, ever win, and will always be priority number one from his own tribe going out pre-merge. But this move, in a vacuum, I actually really like, trying to kind of build some trust early with people who maybe might consider working with him later.
Right. The debate, I think, is about whether he needs to reveal the idol. So, conceivably, could he have just gone up to, say, Troy, Zan, and Leaf and Tarzan and said, okay, we have five, they have four, we're voting them out, that's it? Or did he need, like, the force, for lack of a better word, that the idol gave him in order to accomplish that?
That's a good question. I think it would, I believe it would certainly be in all of their best interests to join up with Colton and vote out at least one of the Frat Boy Alliance. But that being said, I don't know that they necessarily would have before getting rid of Colton, because I think if they don't know at that first tribal council that he can't be voted out, and they don't necessarily, like, if they all just throw their votes on Colton, and if he has the idol, allow him to take out whoever he wants, they're kind of setting themselves up in the future to, they then go in maybe 4-3, maybe 3-4, once they can then boot Colton at the next tribal council with the frat guys, and I think that's a risky position to take. But once they know that Colton has that idol, they then know that, okay, at the first tribal council we go to, he's going to play that, one of these muscle guys is definitely going to go out, and then after that, the idol's gone, and we can then take out Colton and have 4-3 over a majority in our own tribe, and still be 7 strong, hopefully entering the merge.
Looking at it from Colton's perspective for a minute, an interesting decision from him is, let's say you lose the next challenge, you go to tribal council. After all this has happened, after you think you've got this alliance in place, do you play the idol or not?
That's a good question. I think if you're Colton, you probably... I think you still have to.
Well,
just, what do you think?
I don't think he has to, because... Or rather, I don't think he should, because if... If, like, let's say he's gone to Tarzan and Troy Zan people and explain the situation to them. If, after all of that, they still aren't voting with him, and they're voting him out, he's dead to rights anyway. You know, he survived one tribal council by using the idol, but he's gone after that. So, in that situation, he can't win anyway, he buys himself 3 more days, at the most. Whereas, if those people are convinced by him, then playing the idol there is just, obviously it's worthless, it wastes the idol. And it means that they can go through with a plan of, say, booting him at the following tribal council and keeping the men's tribe 7 strong. I'm not sure if the Misfits are aggressive enough to do that. You have people like Jonas and Leaf who probably aren't going to be actively strategizing, but that's still something he has to consider. And if he can make it through the first tribal council without using his idol, then that's better for him. He shouldn't try to have any kind of fancy play syndrome where he draws all the votes to him and then he uses the idol and Matt's gone and it's a fantastic blindside or whatever. He should just do what's most efficient.
Yeah, and we saw that kind of that instinct between Christina and Francesca in the first episode of Redemption Island, where they said, oh, we're going to take over this game, we're going to get them to vote on one of us, and I'm going to play the idol, and then Boston Rob's going to go, or whatever. And really, that may, even in a perfect world, that'll work once, and then you're still just going to be the next one to go. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think that's a bad comparison, because Boston Rob's hold of that tribe is so absolute that unless he was taken out immediately, they were done. If he was gone after the first tribal council, then it's possible that, for instance, they could exploit the fact that Andrea didn't get along well with the other girls, or that, you know, Grant was older than most of them, maybe more mature, and didn't like Natalie and Ashley's laziness or something. You know, there was room for them to play that as long as Boston Rob was gone. Given that Boston Rob was there, they, you know, they had no future in the game, basically.
You know, not every comparison is going to be flawless, but I still think the situation, even if they do somehow manage to hit Boston Rob with the idol on that first vote, which I think, granted, is pretty much never, ever going to happen considering they went ahead and split the votes, they're still, I don't know how forgiving the rest of the Boston Rob kind of Kool-Aid drinkers are going to be when they don't really have much incentive to now work with Francesca and Christina and could still... And obviously, probably not Philip, and could still stay five strong. And I don't know that Francesca and Christina were the kind of players that could work their way into crack those alliances.
Right, but what other options did they have? I mean, were they just going to? They couldn't just sit there and let themselves get picked off.
That's true. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. They were in a tough spot when they're on the outs on a tribe with Boston Rob pre-merge.
Right. The way to look at it, I think, is that we don't know whether the Ometepe Alliance without Boston Rob would have formed organically without him. It's possible that it could because they were all fairly young, you know. That
yeah, I think it's a very natural.
Right, but it's possible that it wouldn't have done. And so, if you take out Boston Rob early, then that alliance is still pretty loose. They haven't really got to know each other yet, and you can maybe swing a few of them, you know, against each other.
I don't know. They were clawing at Phil Shepard before the first boot. I don't know how interested people, the rest of the Ometepe tribe would have been in working with Philip and Francesca and Christina. But back, let's get back to One World. I think just back to Colton, in terms of whether or not to use the idol, should they, you know, when the men end up going to a tribal council with the nine of them. Even if he's secure that Leaf, Troyzan, Jonas, and Tarzan are probably going to be on his side, and will definitely, obviously, be on his side he knows he's going to be safe if he plays it. I think he also needs to realize that every guy's priority has to be getting him out before a swap happens. Because they're as dumb as some of them may appear, they can't possibly be foolish enough to take him confidently and let him play with the women on the same tribe. And for that reason, I think if I'm Colton, it has to go through his head that the guys are certainly aware of how in with the women he is and how much he'd rather be working with them, to the point that I think any time they can, they have to be trying to get him out pre-swap.
Yeah, definitely. And so taking out Colton, it comes with two things. Firstly, it prevents him having his toe in two pools, if you like, with the Misfits and the women, making him potentially one of the most powerful players in the game. And secondly, it also makes sure that people like Mike and Jay are more likely to stay on board with the men, because if you go along with taking out Matt and then take out Colton, you can make the excuse that, well, Colton chose the idol, we were scared, we just went along with him and took him out the earliest chance we could, we still want to work with you. If you, say, take out Matt and then Mike and then Jay and then Bill's left wondering, well, you know, can I really trust these guys?
You know, when we talk about Colton as one of the leading worst of all time candidates, I think this is, and you know, their arguments, like we give him credit for showing them the idol, but I think the main basis for that kind, for our criticism of him, is that he's put himself in such a position after just the first 6 days where it's in everyone's best interest on his own tribe to boot it, like it's a pressing issue to get rid of him before the swap comes. And that's why he's done all of that. He's created that entire thing himself.
Right. He's like, obviously, if you can drag him that far, he's the ideal person to take to the end, because I don't think he's like Russ and Hurst versus Burns. I can't see him winning in pretty much any Final Three scenario, even one involving, you know, like people like Tarzan or Cat or whoever, who wouldn't get much respect. He just alienates people. He has this thing about him. So yeah, but like Russell and him versus Burns, even though your ideal endgame probably involves Russell, you can't afford to let him stay in the game because it introduces an element of chaos that you just can't control.
Yeah, that I think that's a very good point. So just to quickly wrap up about this now kind of misfit alliance, when we see we actually get a really kind of a funny confessional from Jonas where it's the middle of the night when Colton's just shown him the idol and the camera's right up in Jonas's face and I don't know what it is about the way Jonas talks. He seems to talk much slower than I would have expected. Did you notice that? And he seemed to be kind of talking very, very slowly about how awesome the situation was.
And he uses the word bro an awful lot.
I think he does that. I think he's trying to do. I don't know that he does that when he's being a sushi chef. I think he's doing that when he sees the guys he's with on his tribe.
You think he could at least like vary his vocabulary a bit, throw in a few dudes or mates or, you know.
Well, we don't say mate. No,
go the whole
no one
like bro ham or whatever. I don't know.
No one calls. We consider people who call their friends their mates foolish little Australians or Brits. We don't. I don't have any mates. So anyway, let's get right into the immunity challenge. I guess I didn't really have anything to say about the wrapping up the five people. So right into the immunity challenge. Now we saw in a preview before this episode aired, we saw pretty early in the week what this immunity challenge was going to be. And this is not the first time we've seen this immunity challenge. It's the one where the whole tribe is lined up on a balance beam. The person on the far end needs to get to the opposite far end, then the next person goes, and so on and so forth. We've seen this in Fiji and in Vanuatu. And Vanuatu, it was also split men versus women.
Yeah, okay. So a few things about that challenge. One is that all the women, you know, were stripped down to their bikinis, which, you know, was good for time. Then, you know, has to balance out and we get Tarzan in his marathon, which, yeah, things that have been seen can't be unseen. Wouldn't you want to have clothes on so that the person standing next to you can, like, hold on to them and maneuver themselves around you?
That's an excellent point. There are actually a couple facets of this challenge that I don't really... I feel like there have been, you know, we saw in Fiji that they kind of one of the tribes kind of, quote, solved this challenge, which is to say that the person who is serving as the obstacle would just kind of bend down and try to balance standing, like, just bend over as far as they possibly could and just get small, and then the person would just kind of leapfrog and walk over them. And then in this challenge, we saw something that was brought to my attention that it didn't occur to me. But one of my friends who also watches the show said, you know, when Kat was trying to cross Christina, and Christina ended up falling in the water, Kat then got criticized because she also jumped back in the water. If she doesn't have to jump back into the water when the person she's trying to get around falls in, why doesn't she just push everyone just into the water and just walk straight through?
Well, better than that, why doesn't everyone just jump and let her walk?
Yeah, no matter what, if only the person, if anyone who's not the one trying to get from point A to point B can fall in the water at no penalty to the person trying to get through, then why doesn't everyone just jump off?
Yeah, I assume it's the sort of thing which Jeff would point out as angle shooting. Like, last season when Sophie was yelling at Albert to pick up the pieces in the challenge, like, in theory, within the rules that Jeff explained, that makes sense, but obviously in practice they're not going to allow that.
But the thing is, Jeff's counter to the Sophie yelling at Albert to pick up pieces of was, Sophie, this is an individual challenge. And I understand that doing perhaps what we're suggesting would be certainly against the spirit of the challenge. But I still don't think, I don't know how he can call you on it on a technicality.
Well,
it's pretty easy to call it a technicality. Well, I understand that they'll make up a rule and then insert it, I guess. No, but anyway, so just before we've even seen this challenge, after seeing the first challenge and historically seeing the opening challenges in men versus women seasons, and this is probably going to sound chauvinistic, which I understand, they of course have to make kind of a concerted effort to, it's kind of balance the challenges out, which is, I guess, play on words that will get balance the challenges out.
Thanks for explaining that for our audience. I'm sure they couldn't have got it by themselves.
I got to start giving the listeners too much instead of too little credit. So anyway, this is a challenge where, just based on what we've seen historically, is 100% about balance and making oneself as small as possible. And I said, and that's a direct quote from a post I made on 2+2 after seeing the preview, because we saw in the first challenge they had that giant balance beam, which has held up the men at several different, at both men versus women seasons in the opening challenge before. I have to think that the Survivor producers were aware of that when they set up that massive balance beam in the opening challenge.
It's weird how you never see people crouch when they're walking across it. Like, you see these guys just try to run across a beam, and of course that's going to end in failure. Like, the way to walk across a beam is, you crouch down, you spread your arms out, and you lower your center of gravity. Like, people often say that people like James Clement are going to be good in challenging things, but there's only a very small subject of challenges which require just brute strength. A lot of them you're going to be good at if you can outthink the challenge, or at least come up with a way to do it properly.
Like, right,
I remember John Fincher, when he was on Rob Paz's podcast, said that one of the reasons they always did so well in challenges was that in the little strategy sessions beforehand, John would come up with, like, the way to approach the challenge, and they would execute it properly.
Yeah, there's certainly a huge aspect of taking a correct approach going into the challenge. But it's one of these things where when it's a balance beam, it's just common knowledge, and anyone who's ever seen season 6 or season 9 can tell you that the men are going to struggle on the balance beam, and the women are going to not have much of a problem with it. And I made this post because, first of all, I saw someone else say something slightly misogynistic, which I then felt gave me free license. If I can just read the beginning of this, I was talking earlier about our prognostication skills, and I feel like I really hit the nail right on the head with this, given how we saw this play out. Quote, running this challenge split by gender is absolute insanity, as we saw in Vanuatu. It's 100% balance and making oneself as small as possible. This is the female equivalent of production running a weight-bearing challenge, men versus women. And point being, the women are going to run away with this challenge every single time. So, on to this episode's immunity challenge. And now this is yet another challenge where we see balance being that critical issue, which I would, just to be clear, once again assert production is fully aware of, and in no sense is this evening the playing field for the women. This is giving them a blatant advantage. So let's talk about the challenge itself, and let's talk specifically about Kat.
Sure.
So Kat struggled at this challenge, to say the least. She was deemed, I guess she volunteered to be the first one of the females to travel the whole distance, get the other seven of them. So, and we see her, you know, make some mental errors, jumping in when she doesn't have to. Not a strong performance. It ultimately cost the women the victory, and this is and kind of Kat's place in the tribe is the theme we see throughout the rest of the challenge. So, first thoughts about that, I guess.
Well, there's not really much to say. I mean, in a vacuum, we think, okay, Kat going across, perfectly fine, makes sense. Given that she apparently doesn't understand English or physics or anything at all, really, it's like, it may have been a bad decision.
I don't want to just be some now blind cheerleader for Kat. I am completely in love with her personality. I think she is gorgeous. That said, I obviously not thrilled with her performance in this challenge. However, I feel like she took so much heat for something somewhat justifiable. I can understand, you know, probably jumping in twice at a time where it was detrimental to the team, not the best idea. But I certainly don't. I think the heat she's been taking on the internet and perhaps with Nina within her tribe and with Monica within her tribe, it was one challenge. I don't think she's that bad in random challenges, and I certainly didn't feel like that one performance did anything to signal to the rest of her kind of core alliance that she was a liability in any way. Apart from a purely balance and communication challenge, I think she's going to be fine in most other challenges.
Right, and it's not as if her failure necessarily doomed the women in that challenge. If they just had her go last, they never would have had a problem. Like, once you see she's struggling, you can just say, okay, Kat, you can go later, you know, Monica or Kim or whoever, tag in, you go first. Like, it's not as if Kat's presence in the tribe is just an automatic death sentence for the women. Like, they brought this loss on themselves collectively.
I don't want it to be just kind of blind cheerleading, but that I do kind of have a soft spot in my heart for Kat. And also, I just got an email a couple hours ago. Kat is the first survivor ever to follow me on Twitter.
And presumably the last.
And presumably, well, she follows you too. So.
Oh yeah, that's what it's.
I saw she has like 600 followers and is also following like 599 people. But I'll tell you, that email did my day. It's Kat Edorson, or I think that's her last name. It's now following you.
It's good to know you're so easily pleased.
It is. Listen, yeah, hey man, just follow me. It's at Colin Stone.
See, that bar's getting cut out as well. You can't just, like, haul yourself out for followers on the podcast. That's a word.
Okay. Cut that out then. But I'm thrilled that Kat's following me. Okay, so where are we going next with this? Okay, so I think we should talk a bit about now we see after the women have lost the challenge that the boot's going to either be Nina, who's kind of on the outside and is older, or Kat, who's on the inside, but had obviously that not-so-stellar challenge performance. First thoughts about this?
Well, what I thought was most interesting about it was we see the decision being presented as one being made by Kim and Chelsea. And you might think, well, that's natural because they're potentially the swing votes. You know, they can go one way or the other, and either way they go, they can form a majority to take however they want. But it still suggests that, you know, Sabrina, who is normally the leader of the tribe, maybe isn't the one calling all the shots.
Yeah, that's interesting. After the results aired and everything, there was a lot of speculation in the 2+2 thread about how things could have gone differently, and we'll be talking about that in just a second.
Yeah, so Sabrina's leadership might be something which they find useful for camp life and challenging things, but it doesn't actually extend to strategic leadership.
Yeah, and I think that when you're Kim and Chelsea, that's exactly what you want Sabrina's leadership. You want her to be the figurehead for the alliance, but you want to be the ones controlling things.
Right, and in Nina's post-game interviews, and again, if you consider this spoilery, just mute for a few seconds, we won't be on it for very long, she said that Kim was the one who was running the show behind the scenes, she thought. She described her as a manipulator and a villain, which
was
interesting. An interesting choice of words, given that it doesn't square with anything we've seen so far.
And that's actually very interesting. We're going to talk about Kim in just a little bit. the decision ultimately, I think, was pretty straightforward. Although we did see that scene where Chelsea says to Kim, like, you know, Kat may legitimately be a liability. I don't know. Clearly, she said it to her because we have footage of her saying it to her, and they showed it. I don't know how much truth there really is in that, first of all. And then also, I don't know if they were ever really even considering voting out Nina. Do you think that ever really legitimately crossed their mind as something they might do?
Well, I think what happens is it was such an obvious decision. Like, if before the season started, most people had Nina pegged as the first boot from the women's tribe. So they thought, well, how can we make this not as predictable as it might be? So you over-exaggerate Kat's failure at the challenge and the extent to which people are mad at her, and you lay the seeds for that early in the episode so that it looks like there's actually a decision being made. Whereas, in fact, what I imagine happened was they kind of maybe discussed it for a few minutes and they thought, well, no reason to do it yet, okay, and then Nina was gone. And it was a consensus vote among...
Most of the... dispute we saw about who the boots were going to go, about Kat going, was from both Nina and Monica, not really from the people. Apart from that, just one line from Chelsea. No one else really said anything to the effect of maybe we should boot Kat. So if we think about the long-term implications of this Nina versus Kat boot, how do you think that plays out?
If we start with the assumption that they want this group of them to be the final five, which, yeah, probably shouldn't be as tight an assumption as it is, because you're probably going to have people like Tarzan or Choizan around near the end who are goats who aren't going to affect the game in any meaningful way and who should be kept around. But what we see often is that alliances have this kind of markers of clean feed rules in place where it's like, well, we've agreed to get down to this point and then fight it out, and we're not going to consider backstabbing ourselves before that. So if we assume that they get down to final five together, then what happens is Elise is obviously a goat, Kat is presumably a goat, and so everyone else wants to be the third person in the final three of those two.
Right.
And those other three would be Chelsea, Kim, and Sabrina, or potentially Monica if something weird happens. Now, if Elisa and Kat are thinking rationally, and that's a big assumption to make, given what we've seen from them so far, they're going to be aware of the fact that they're disliked and thinking, well, we need to take the least popular person out of those three to the end. So at Final Five, the most popular person will go, presumably Kim, and then at Final Four, whoever's the most popular remaining person will go, which I imagine would be Sabrina. So if you're Chelsea there, you're in a great spot because you have this natural setup where you're going to make the Final Three and win a large percentage of the time unless somebody wins an immunity at the wrong time. It may be that given what transpires later, that Chelsea becomes more popular than Kim or whatever, but in general you want to be the third most popular person in the final five if everyone's alliance structure is fluid.
Yeah, because it was a big concept last year because we had that final five that was so tight, and what you really need to consider when you're making these deals early is if this alliance does go all the way, what will the natural result of that be? And we saw, I think, a good example of that from last season is Jim Rice, where if Savai takes the numbers, we went through it a ton of times. By the way, friend of the show, Jim Rice, if he takes the numbers post-merge, I think we've gone through the natural result of that is going to be either him or Cochran winning a huge percentage of the time. And so it gets this kind of thinking, this perhaps what people would call overly forward thinking, like thinking too far in the future in the game. It becomes actually really critical even this far back, because if you are setting this alliance up with the goal of that being your end game, you need to make sure that that's a good end game for you, more than it's just safety for right now.
Right, and this podcast patron saying ESPN's Gary Wise argued when he was on last season that one of Jim's flaws that he was thinking too far ahead, for instance with the Elise boot, it was an example of fancy play syndrome. But I think you have to be thinking in those kind of terms if you're going to set yourself up well for the long game. I think the mistake a lot of people make is that, by definition, since it's so far away, the effects, the impact of it isn't really tangible until you get there. So, you can get to day 36 or whatever and find yourself screwed over by a decision you made on day 13. But since they're so far apart, that doesn't really register with you until after the game when you look back at it and really analyze what decisions you made.
Yeah, and if you want to look at it specifically about Jim again, just because it's a popular example that I'm hoping people will remember, even when it is that early, Jim still knows, and if we want to look at that Elise boot, I think that's the opposite of fancy play syndrome. I think that's one of the most forward-thinking moves in Survivor history, and I think it was brilliant, honestly. Because what he knows is if Savai then gets to Final Six, it's going to be him, Don, and Cochran, Ozzy, Keith, and Whitney. He knows Keith and Whitney are going to be a pair, and he knows Ozzy's going to be that massive physical threat. He knows Don's going to be the automatic jury winner, and he knows Cochran is going to be someone who's probably going to be a bit, perhaps not desperate, but willing to work with him. And he knows that and everyone else knows all of those things, too. And because of all of those factors, when those are the final six, both Jim and Cochran do very, very well. And Jim knew that, whereas if he were to boot Cochran instead of Elise, he would then be going into a different final six where the natural result is going to be an Ozzy, Elise, Keith, Whitney final four most of the time, which is obviously not good for Jim.
Right, and it's possible that this can change. So let's say Chelsea starts winning lots of immunities and people get scared of that and think, well, we need to take her out beforehand or whatever. So things are liable to change, especially since we have a swap which could mix up the alliances or whatever. But this isn't, you know, what we're saying doesn't rely on any specific alliance being in place. It's a general point. You know, in a situation where everyone's thinking rationally, you want to be in the middle of the pack in terms of your status as a threat, both.
Yeah, definitely. One other thing I wanted to talk about with regard to the Women's Tribal Council is Jeff asked the girls if he would redo the alliances, if they could do it all over again, if they would kind of reform who they aligned with. And Chelsea and I think someone else said yes, and then went on to still not vote out the person that they clearly were referring to in terms of who they would be replacing. Dom, do you have some thoughts about that scene or about that part of the scene in terms of good, bad on Chelsea's part? I'm sure it was an honest answer.
Well, yeah, but honestly, as we know, it isn't always the best policy. I mean, she made pretty much the worst decision you could make there. But I think both, you know, saying, yeah, okay, Kat screwed up, I want to get rid of her is fine if you're going to do that. I think saying, I forgive Kat, we're going to move on with her, it's fine if you're going to do that. But saying one thing and then doing the other, it just doesn't make any sense, because now Kat, if she's smart, which apparently she isn't, is...
Well...
Yeah, okay. But Kat is going to be thinking, well, she's saying she wouldn't include me if she's doing this again. Why do I have any reason to trust her? It's just an obvious thing to think. Okay, so the discussion we just had about the optimal structure of an alliance and all that, why we brought that up is to explain why we think that keeping Kat was the right move, in particular for Chelsea and Kim, who seem to be the decision makers here. It seems like both Nina and Kat would be goats, in that Nina didn't seem that popular within her own tribe, presumably wasn't with the men either, and she seemed to have this kind of grating manner about her that alienated people. So the fundamental structure of the alliance doesn't really change, unless Nina is so grateful to Kim and Chelsea that she sticks with them against her own interests, which... Yeah, I don't think she would do, personally.
Right, yeah.
So you have to weigh the minimal likelihood of that against the possibility that, say, Alicia, who seems to be close with the cat, is going to be angry at you, or that, you know, the rest of the tribe actually doesn't want to do this and you can't actually make it happen. You know, it seems like just blithely saying, oh, well, they should have voted out Kat instead of Nina, it ignores the reality of the situation, and it assumes that it was even a possible decision for them to make, which I don't think it was. I mean, Nina, Monica, and Christina seem to be in an alliance, and yet they all voted for different people. I mean, Monica voted for Christina. So this clearly wasn't a cohesive group. And you might use that as an argument for the decision. So if Chelsea and Kim had joined up with them, they'd be able to control things within that group, within this new group. But again, I don't think the risk of the move was worth it. It's just, I think that would be an example of fancy play syndrome at this stage.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think there are various, like, there are a couple short-term arguments for flipping. And I think the resounding argument against it is that there's already a very solid group in place. And two of the five that you're in the group with, it appears, will not win a jury vote. And again, they seem to be loyal to you, and they seem to be very eager to work with you, and hopefully be eager to go to the end with you. And whoever you are, you know, obviously speaking in the second person here about any of Chelsea, Sabrina, or Kat, or excuse me, or Kim, whichever of the, all of them have incentive to keep both Alicia and Kat because they're, as I mentioned, loyal, and they're also not going to win a jury vote. Now, Nina probably also not going to win a jury vote, although Monica certainly could, and neither of them is going to have the loyalty, I don't think, anywhere near what Kat's going to have to that group, because I don't know what else Kat's going to do.
For sure. I mean, it's a matter of Nina's personal loyalty to Chelsea and Kim rather than her loyalty to the group, because like, if you're Chelsea and Kim, you don't really care if Nina's going to be loyal to Sabrina or whatever. But I see your point.
Yeah. And another thing to consider is, once again, and this is a big assumption to be making, but I still think it's a very fair assumption to make at this point, is the tribe swap. And there are going to be a much higher number of good tribe swap combinations when Kat's in the draw instead of Nina, for if you're one of those female alliance members.
Right. The worry is that Monica and Christina now know that they're on the outs, and that so if there is a tribe swap, they could jump over to the men. That might be an argument actually for booting Christina first instead of Nina, but given how weak Nina seems to be at challenges, I think keeping Christina is correct there as well.
Yeah, I thought about that because I was wondering, and I was thinking that might have been, because I was thinking about why those three all voted differently, and the one I couldn't piece together was Monica voting Christina, and the only way I could see it making sense is if she did not know how the rest of the tribe was voting and thought that Christina was just the most likely person that Alicia would want gone. Which seems insane to me, because Nina knew that, or I guess Nina was the one rallying for Kat to be the one to go, and she voted for Kat. But or maybe Monica was just, if she's unwilling to vote for Nina, why vote for the other person that's also not going to be, that's also on the outside?
Right. And looking forward a bit, it may be that Alicia has this kind of Brandon Hunt syndrome where her worst qualities are exaggerated for the sake of the cameras, and for most of the time she's out there, people like her. But if I'm in that alliance of five, I'm thinking, well, I can keep Alicia, who seems to be erratic, who, you know, is very loud, and who's probably trustworthy, but isn't really, who's unpredictable. Or I can keep the loyalty of Monica and Christina, both of whom are rational players who seem to be easy to, you know, get along with, strategize with. The closest analog might be to Heroes vs. Villains, actually, where, you know, Parvati and Russell in a tight alliance. If Parvati boots Russell at the last Pure Metal Tribal Council, she gains the loyalty of Sandra and Courtney, and ensures that they have this tight group of five going into the merge. Whereas keeping Russell means that there's guaranteed to be one outsider there that's considering flipping. This might not be as drastic as that, because Monica seems to be all about girl power and stuff, but it's something to consider, at least.
Yeah, and Monica, I think she seems very level-headed, and she definitely seems like she's thinking about the game basically correctly. Now, granted, again, that Christina vote still is pretty nuts to me. I doubt she's trying to set someone else up to make it look like someone else. I'm sure, you know, whatever conspiracy theory, is poorly forming in my head is probably not the reality of the situation. But just back to Monica. I like her. I honestly think if she can make it to the swap, she's going to have a good chance, because I think she's going to get along well with the guys. She's not going to be viewed as a threat, because the guys will eventually figure out that the five girls that have been kind of running the show on the female tribe. I think Monica is going to have a lot of different combinations to go far. I don't know. I certainly don't think she's getting a winner edit. We're going to be talking about the edits very soon. Let's get right to the big picture here. Let's get to the editing. It's in my opinion, fair to say that, like I mentioned before, we have three kind of big front runners: Sabrina, Kim, and Jonas. Who do you want to start with?
We'll start with Sabrina, I think. Sabrina is an interesting case because her edit, where she's the main narrator of the tribe, she's like the most strategic person in the game, in the sense that the editors are focusing on her the most. She's getting a lot of visibility. These are all things we tend to associate with big male characters. So we think of people like Marty, people who tend to not have a bright future in the game, but who are important to the way the season plays out. And I think she's going to fit into that mold. I think the fact that her edit is fairly unique in that sense for a woman is leading people to think she's a winner, but she's a typical kind of distraction, if you like.
Yeah, this is, I said Sabrina's edit feels less like a winner edit probably, and more like kind of a long-term big character edit. And, you know, maybe like we saw that second place edit, given maybe that's the effect they were going for with that quote. Maybe upon a rewatch we'll say, oh, well, the quote I mentioned earlier about no one remembers second place. Maybe, you know, people watching the season down the line already knowing the results are going to say that and retrospectively say, oh, wow, I guess I should have seen this coming. No, so, you know, I certainly like Sabrina. I like that she's definitely being shown as the most active game player, which at this point is probably not the greatest news. But I still like that she's being shown as someone who's thinking about the game. I don't really like how she's handling her interactions with the men tribe, and I certainly don't like that she was willing to so enthusiastically be the leader. Anything else about Sabrina before we get to Jonas and Kim?
No, that's fine. If we move on to Kim, then. Kim, it has been under the radar, but when she does say things, they make a lot of sense, and they develop the audience's knowledge of her as a character. You know, it's not something like Jay, where he says, oh, we won the challenge today, and we won a TARP or whatever. It's stuff which gives you information about her and what's happening in the game as it relates to her. And that's what you're looking for from someone who doesn't have a lot of screen time. That what they say has to be valuable, and it is from Kim.
Right, yeah. And I think, you know, you could say the same about Jonas, who we'll get to. Kim, I think, is getting, I think, along with Jonas, is getting just absolutely blessed by the editors. I think a big thing, kind of along the same lines of what you mentioned, what to look for in terms of potential winning candidates, is kind of get a picture in your mind of what the editors probably had to work with in terms of footage to include in the episode. Both for that individual and just in terms of storyline, and then think about what they actually chose to include. And I think that kind of principle is something that you see most seasons, and I think that's what kind of threw us on Sophie being the winner last season, because just knowing that Sophie was such a strategic, you know, figuring that Sophie was such a strategic thinker, that she would probably have these pretty interesting confessionals that surely they would be showing if she were to go on to win the game, which, you know, we were wrong.
Yeah, well, I think the thing about Sophie was that if you think about the story of the season as a whole, it was, I think at least, Coach plays a great strategic game, but fails to live up to his desire to play honourably. And when he's in front of the jury, he can claim to have done one or two things, to have played this great game or to have played honourably, and he chose the one that he failed at, and accordingly, he lost. And that's a good storyline for the season, I think. The problem with it, for people who are trying to predict what's going to happen, is that firstly, it can only be resolved at the very end of the season at the final tribal council, so in the last episode.
Right.
And also, it means that a lot of the stuff we see early on about how Coach is playing this great game is going to mislead you into thinking that this is setting him up to win, at the expense of other people like Sophie, who maybe were under-edited. The thing that worries me about Kim is that before the season, we and seemingly everybody else had already announced a coronation for the day of the finale, it seemed. And I think a lot of that has bled into how people are analysing the show now, where they kind of pick up on everything that Kim says as evidence that she's going to win, to kind of make it a self-fulfilling prophecy, if you like, or to kind of confirm what they've already predicted. But honestly, the edits of everyone else are sorely deficient in some respect or another. So Kim is up there by default, and if you look at her edit on its own merits, it does look pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. And you may certainly be onto something. You know, I'm way too in love with too many of these girls. This is, by the way, I had my notes somewhere that I can't believe I forgot to mention it. This may be the strongest female cast there's ever been in terms of just overall value.
In terms of
just overall female cast, but like I would watch roughly, if you were told you're going to get to watch a random season female cast play and you find out that it's this, like you're going to pull a season out of a hat and that's the female cast you have to watch forever, some extreme example, I would be thrilled if this was it compared to the other seasons.
I disagree with that. I think that's a function of two things. Firstly, the men versus women twist, where by definition, let's say the women's tribe loses, the majority of focus is going to be on them. And so they're going to have a lot of the development. And secondly, they've lost both challenges so far, so they've had to have that kind of development, where we know nothing of the men because they haven't been relevant to the story yet. And
no, that's
if you took Like, let's say you take the female cast of, I don't know, name a season.
Nicaragua.
Okay, Nicaragua's a great example, actually. I think that had a great female cast, barring a few duds like...
I like Brenda, I liked Alina, you know, the list goes on. I like that cast.
Yeah, if that had been a Men vs. Women season, I think you'd be saying the same thing about that season. Same with, like, China, for instance, where a lot of good female characters.
No. The Brenda and Alina aside, they still had Jane, Nyanka, and Purple Kelly.
Right, but Jane and Nyanka still brought something to the show, in the same way that Alicia does.
I think Nyanka specifically was way above and beyond anyone else I'd ever seen. I've never wanted to turn the TV off for anyone else. I've never wanted to fast forward.
Right, I mean, I personally hated Jane and Nyanka, and I haven't rewatched the season yet because of that. I just can't bear the thought of having to endure that. But a lot of people found them, if not entertaining, at least, you know, they love to hate them. And so, if you're analysing that cast as a whole, I think it's a great female cast. And I think you can say the same about a lot of other seasons. And, like, but before this season started, I was saying, I thought the cast as a whole was pretty weak, and I still stand by that.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do.
Wow. I'm loving this cast, honestly. And it may be just my youthful exuberance and my relentless optimism. I don't know. But I think one thing that kind of speaks to your point about how I may be liking the women, just because we've seen, you know, both episodes have been probably 75% women. Certainly this last one was almost solely focused on the women and then just Colton. But the other person that we've seen throughout all of that kind of pop up every so often with some funny or insightful things to say is Jonas. And that's I think, why, to speak to your point about we haven't seen much of the men's tribe, but for whatever reason, we've seen plenty of Jonas I think people would be more inclined to predict that we would be seeing a lot more of Matt early, for instance, in terms of he's the one running the big muscle alliance. But Jonas just has been popping up in pretty positive ways. Thoughts on Jonas?
Right. I think his edit is good mainly because of the fact that the women collectively seem to get completely buried this previous episode. Like, it was portrayed towards the end that keeping Kat over Nina was a mistake for all of them. And this was a decision that they were all responsible for. And, you know, you had Jeff saying in Tribal Council, this is one of the worst starts of tribe we've had. You had a lot of the individual women saying, oh, well, this is never going to work because women as a group always fail. You know, had Courtney saying that, Sabrina, right, and so on. It's kind of reminiscent of Fang, I think, where I think Gabon's a great example, where a lot of the people with the best edits seem to be on Fang. So Matty and Kenny towards the end. But their tribe had been so buried by the editing that you had to look for the other tribe for a winner candidate, and that person ended up being Bob. We might be seeing the same thing here, where Jonas' edit isn't far and above everybody else's, but it's good enough given that the women collectively are being shat on by the editors.
There's been a lot of talk. I just was skimming through the thread before we started recording this, and someone said they were, I think it was 75% sure a female was going to win. What do you think? You know, the women are obviously down now 2-0, and it's obviously very early, and we don't know what's going to happen. Just gut reaction. What do you think the women versus men coming out as a winner chances would be?
That might be pretty fair, actually, 75%, because Bill, we know now, is just not going to win. I can't imagine him being completely invisible in the opening episode and coming back to win. And he was one of the main winner candidates for the men, I think. Michael maybe has a decent winner set, or Big Mike, if you want to call him that. But beyond that, if it's Jonas versus, you know, Kim and Sabrina and, you know, potentially Monica, maybe, I think that's a fair estimate.
What do you think about Leaf? Because Leaf is someone I wanted to talk about in terms of edit. We still haven't seen much of him.
Well, exactly. I think if he had one, we'd be getting a lot more personal development from him. It would be this positive growth story, the little engine that could, for lack of a better phrase. Trials and over the odds.
I'm becoming a fan of Leaf, honestly. Not that I don't know that I wasn't a fan of his in the first place. I guess I just wasn't optimistic. I think out of all the guys that we said, when we were doing our pre-show thing where we said, if they can kind of hide the true douche inside of them, they could do all right. And that's, I think Leaf's the one doing the best job of that. Not that he's necessarily...
Oh, sure.
Yeah, you know.
Sure, I mean, he seems like a nice guy, and he seems to be getting well with people. Like, people seem to respect him.
The alternative theory is that he just came off poorly in his CBS interview. Maybe he was nervous or whatever.
Yeah, that's fair. And, you know, when you're out there, you're not constantly talking all the time. You're not answering predictable questions from interviews and stuff. It's just, you know, it's natural human interaction, which he seems to be good at. So
yeah, quite good. So I guess just to wrap up Survivor before we get into the Amazing Race. So who do you think? Closing question: who do you have at the top of your power rankings going into next week?
I think it has to be Kim and Jonas in some order, with Sabrina lodged in there at third. So I'll give the top spot to Kim for this week.
Who is your dark horse? Who is the long shot but that might win?
Dark horse? I'm going to have to say Troy-san, actually.
Hmm.
As loath as I am to say that, given that you made a horrible pick in the draft, I think that he's had some random comments as well that, you know, didn't need to be there, and which, if you're looking just for entertainment value, shouldn't have been there. And, you know, I don't think he's going to be a great player. I think if he does win, he'll be one of the worst winners, I'd imagine, but I wouldn't count him out just yet. I'll put it like that.
Those are very interesting picks. Troy-san was my dark horse pick to win. I think my dark horse pick is like I said, is Troy-san. In terms of my power rankings this week, you know, last week we came on and you and Gary, you know, came right out with having Jonas as number one in his power rankings, and you said you weren't surprised. And I kind of gave a surprised reaction, and I truly was. But the more I really thought about it, and now seeing Jonas kind of through, and you know, maybe it's a situation where I'm looking too far into it. I certainly agree that Jonas and Kim and Sabrina have to be the top three. I think Sabrina has to be number three. And I would actually put Jonas at number one, I think. I think he's going to be set up beautifully in almost every post-swap and post-merge situation for the, a very high percentage of them.
Right. And would we agree that the next three below those are probably Chelsea, Mike, and Jay in some order?
Chelsea, I think, is definitely four. I think Mike, just for lack of other compelling candidates, I don't know that I would have Jay. I think I would have Monica above Jay, for instance.
Oh, sure. I forgot about Monica.
Yeah. I think Jay's up there. I don't know that. I think the front runners are very clearly Jonas and Kim at this point.
Okay. All right. I think that about does it for Survivor Stuff. Okay. So move on to the Amazing Race now, which we're talking about for the first time. Mainly because it features a certain pair of reality stars, which we're going to get to in a minute. But also because it's one of the big reality shows. A lot of people like it. We like it. I know I do. Colin does. And we hope you do as well. So we'll get into that. And the obvious place to start is none other than Brendan and Rachel, who you may remember from Big Brother 12. And you'll remember Rachel in particular from Big Brother 13, which still I'm still in shock over that. I haven't fully recovered yet.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Brendan and Rachel, they went into Big Brother 12. They'd never met. They were strangers. Fell in love in the hammock, as they described. Proceeded the entire summer to kind of isolate themselves from the entire house, which led to one of the most dominant alliances in Big Brother history, just kind of steamrolling the entire house because they were never perceived as a threat as long as both Brendan and Rachel, or just either one of Brendan and Rachel, were in the house. Now, Brendan and Rachel, they also played in Big Brother 13 last season. They were invited back, along with another couple of Amazing Race alumni, Jeff and Jordan, who I think were on season 16 of The Amazing Race, which was actually the last season I watched, just in the interest of full disclosure.
Right, although you probably won't remember those two from The Amazing Race because they bombed pretty badly.
Oh, they made it, I think, five or six episodes. They were, I guess, the original Big Brother kind of sweetheart couple, and then Brendan and Rachel were originally the season prior to Brendan and Rachel's original season. And Brendan and Rachel were kind of the Jeff and Jordan from hell the next season. But that being said, there was a cast member on Big Brother 13 who I think summed up, they have the little portmanteau, Brenchel. And he began the season, his name coincidentally was Dominic, and he was actually a ton of fun to watch for, you know, the first 3 weeks. And when Brendan and Rachel first entered the house, it cuts to Dominic in the diary room saying, Brenchel is a beast of a couple. And I think that's absolutely what we're going to see out of him on The Amazing Race. Rachel, for those of you, I'm not sure if I even said it just now, Rachel won Big Brother 13, and that's what the shock Dom was referring to. I honestly still can't even believe it either, and I thought we were going to see Rachel and Coach go back to back, which would have been the most unreal thing ever. So Dom, what do we know about Brendan and Rachel?
Yeah, I was about to say, for those of you who haven't seen Big Brother, have no frame of reference, imagine if Coach had won Survivor last season. The shock that would produce in the universe is kind of analogous to that. Brendan and Rachel actually seem pretty normal this episode, which disappointed me because I was hoping for something more exciting. As it turned out, most of the laughs actually came from Brendan, who just managed to be variously, you know, incompetent, angry at the world. Yeah, you know, typical Brendan things, really.
I thought the line of the episode was when the Border Patrol people passed them on the car. And I'm half Mexican. I hate them.
I wasn't sure if that was like, racist or not, because like inadvertently stereotyping himself. Like, I don't know.
I don't know. Brendan and Rachel, for those of you, you know, I'm sure plenty of our listeners also watch Big Brother. For those of you who don't, we saw a good showing out of Brendan and Rachel, and I think that's something we can expect to see. However, another thing we can expect to see is when things start not going their way, you are going to get tilted out of your mind as a viewer, because they are insufferable when things start going poorly for them.
Right, and for Rachel in particular, there might not be any bushes around for her to cry in this time. She's all on her own.
To throw that out there now, we are going to be covering this next season of Big Brother, so if you want to be stay up to date on the latest future The Amazing Race pairs, tune into Big Brother and tune into the podcast for that. Let's see, what else to say? How do we think about Brendan and Rachel in terms of long term?
As weird as it sounds, I think they could actually do pretty well, because although The Amazing Race is obviously a very different show from Big Brother, a lot of these kind of challenges are pretty similar things. Like, you have to do certain things under pressure, you have to do similar tasks, and just having 2 seasons worth of experience with that in both of their cases will help them a lot, I think.
Yeah, you know, the challenges are what Brenchel excelled at in Big Brother, which generally speaking is a bad thing, which is why it's kind of it's so hard to believe that Rachel won, considering she's quite poor socially for the most part. But is very, very good at these kind of challenges. And like you mentioned, I think that experience, you know, obviously Big Brother, Survivor, and Amazing Race are all different, very different shows. But we have seen just in Survivor that experience makes a huge difference. And I think experience doing these kind of random CBS concocted tasks, can certainly help them. They're very good. A lot of the Big Brother competitions are just random. There's plenty of endurance, and they excel at basically all of them, and they certainly are very proud of themselves as competitors.
Right. It's difficult to predict how well people do on The Amazing Race, because it's, for lack of a better word, it's not a linear show like Survivor and Big Brother are. In those two shows, if you start out well, that feeds into your success as the show progresses. So if you get in a solid alliance at the start of Survivor, say, and you can maintain that, that'll help you throughout the rest of the game. In The Amazing Race, you can, like the snowboarders last season, you can be at the top of the pack, you can win lots of legs, and then one mistake, you know, one bad leg can cost you the whole game. And you know, there is a lot of variance involved with stuff like, you know, losing passports or missing flights or bad taxi drivers or whatever it may be. But leaving that aside as best we can, I think Brendan and Rachel do have a good shot for all the reasons we just described.
Yeah, given that everyone's going to have a random draw in terms of luck, given that everyone's going to have a random draw at getting the bad taxi cab driver or whatever, I think they're going to have a very good shot, actually, and I can see them winning. Honestly, I think they're one of my front runners, and that's probably just, I'm watching the show basically to see them, I haven't watched since Jeff and Jordan. I don't know who these snowboarders are. I have seen, you know, 12, 13 seasons of the show in the past. One thing I actually, before we get into all the other couples, wanted to ask you about was the team that won this first leg got some kind of speed pass. I'm forgetting what it was called.
Express pass.
But okay, so that's a tremendous advantage. It seems like that should go to the person who got like second to last or something, rather than reward the team who just crushed the entire field.
Right, it seems like if a team's going to win in the first place, they're probably going to be good racers. So you don't really want to enhance the advantage that they already have over the rest of the field, but
yeah.
I don't know. But by the same token, though, if a team is just constantly messing up and stuff, you don't really want to... Well, I guess in a way you do want them to stick around for as long as possible, just because it's fun to watch them fail. But you don't really want that to be given to them, because they're probably just going to go out soon anyway.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so are you ready to get into the other teams?
Well, one thing, last thing I wanted to say about Brendan was, I love Brendan's line when they went to the skydiving task, and he said, oh, she's having the experience of her lifetime. But clearly not happy for her. You could hear the bitterness in his voice. I think even he hasn't registered the fact yet that Rachel won Big Brother and he hasn't. You see at the start of the episode where it's like, he said, oh, we won Big Brother, and Rachel corrects him, no, I won Big Brother.
Yeah, that was really good. I like that. I guess, in the kind of Boston Robin Amber sense, they really did simultaneously win Big Brother, and they're engaged. I guess if it's all going to the same bank account eventually. But yeah, that was quite funny, I thought.
So I'll begin with Dave and Sherry, who are clowns, and therefore were predictably unfunny. They just put me on tilt for the entirety of the episode. I just don't like them. It's just
I think there are a few teams that just need to get out of the way for the actual race to really start, and I think they're one of them. I don't know that I just I they seem like nice enough and happy enough people. They're pretty weird. They're professional clowns. I don't think they're very long for the race. I guess I'm going to be okay with them in small doses, but I'm not going to be overly sad to see them go, and I predict it's going to be pretty soon.
But you see a couple like this on every season, and they're invariably bad. Like, I don't want to watch people play out their midlife crisis on national TV. It just doesn't do anything for me at all. One of the reasons they told me so badly was the line in their intro said they built up karma, and that was going to help them win the race. I thought, oh, well, this is interesting. Like, did they volunteer in Uganda? Did they save people from burning buildings? No, they lied about metaphysics to a bunch of small children. Like, how's that building on karma? That's doing your job.
Oh, the gift of a child's laughter. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't have overly high hopes for them. I guess I don't feel as negatively towards them as you seem to. Do you hate clowns or something? Is that what we're
getting into? I don't have some traumatic event from my childhood which makes me hate clowns. I just didn't like them in particular. Not in the wrong way.
All right, well, that's fair enough. Who's up next?
Next up is Bopper and Mark.
Oh, okay.
These are the hillbillies from Kentucky, who I like them a lot. They seem like nice guys.
Yeah, I thought they were definitely funny. I'm not sure which is which. Is Bopper the guy, the
white guy?
Yeah,
I was talking about this, because, racist man, I thought Bopper would be the black guy, but it seemed like he called the black guy Mark at some point, the white guy did, so I'm not sure.
Well, Bopper's also a very good hillbilly name, and that guy was certainly, and hopefully that's not viewed as like some kind of derogatory term or whatever. That guy's a hillbilly. And I know there was someone in the 2+2 Amazing Race thread, which I, got in a fight with the moderator about after my first post in, but who was from Kentucky and was saying, I was reluctant to see these two. I don't want the Kentucky hillbilly stereotype getting perpetuated, but they were, who ended up actually being happy about, first of all, there being a black guy on the team and kind of, ending the racism, stereotype, although I'm not sure how much that's really accomplished. I think the person overwhelmingly said, I'm happy to see these two guys. They may be kind of not the brightest, but they're at least fun and lighthearted and entertaining. What do you think about their chances in the race itself?
I don't know. I can't really visualize them as winners, to be honest. I think they're going to finish like in the middle of the pack somewhere, so maybe fifth or sixth, something like that.
Yeah, I was thinking like the 6th, 7th range. I'm hoping to see them make a run because I think they are good TV.
Yeah, they finished what, 2nd to last in this leg.
That's right.
We'll get onto that because that was
Third to last. Yeah, 2nd to last of the teams that got to remain. Yeah,
you couldn't really have scripted that ending any better if you tried.
That ending was fit, and we'll be getting to that fittingly at the ending of this podcast.
One other thing about them is, I might be misremembering, but I liked how at the beginning of their intro they had this weird like Wild West music playing when. But it wasn't like that. It's kind of melancholy as well. Like, it's this weird music, like, atonal. Like, I don't know. It was weird. Like, whenever they did something stupid, you could hear this weird.
Oh, they're getting the idiot music that a lot of these reality shows are big on giving them the dimwit music to certain contestants. That's funny. I didn't notice that. I'll listen in for that. Stay tuned. Keep your ears open for that. The dimwit music.
Okay, so next up are Joey and Dan, but Joey apparently is called Fitness, like on the. Whatever. Start talking properly.
Alright, so. It's fine.
It was weird because on the, like, when the lettering comes up at the bottom of the screen saying, like, who these people are and what, you know, what their relationship is to each other, it's like, Joey, in quotation marks, Fitness. Dad is like, is everybody being associated with an abstract noun? Like, we could come up with some wonderful ones with Brendan and Rachel. Oh no, it's these guys actually who finished second to last, I'm sorry. Not Foster and Mark.
Bob and Mark finished second to last of the two couples that got to stay in. So third to last overall. Joey Fitness and Danny, pretty interesting team. And I'm actually, you know, I hate Jersey Shore, the TV show. I think it embodies everything basically that is just wrong with America. But Joey Fitness and Danny, you know, people look at them and they see that stereotypical Jersey Shore kind of person, and they're right. But that's it. I like these guys a lot more than the people on that show. I think they're certainly not going to be a very competitive team for long. Although I think they can. I don't think they're, if they can stay in for a little bit, I don't think they'll perpetually be on the bottom. But eventually they're going to come up. They're going to hit some detour that neither of them is capable of.
They're going to provide a bit of entertainment. We'll probably end up rooting for them, but they won't be able to close, I don't think.
It's fine. I'm actually kind of looking forward to seeing more of these guys, but I don't know how well they're going to end up doing.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. Anything else about these two?
No, I think I'm good.
Okay, then. So next up are Neri and Jamie, I think how you pronounce it. And these are the two federal agents.
I think it is Jamie. Yes, I think that's the pronunciation.
Okay. Yeah. What do you think about these two?
I actually like these two. I think they were the fourth place finishers. These are they are one of two remaining female and female teams. Is that right? Or are there three remaining now?
Oh, that's right.
Okay. Certainly, I think they're the front runners among female and female teams. These guys are former federal or current federal agents. Sorry, I'm too busy thinking about former federal agent Philip Shepard. These guys are current federal agents. And, you know, we saw the intro clip of them in their SWAT gear firing these rifles, and I was actually really, you know, there were cops detectives a few seasons ago in Jeff and Jordan's season, but this is a whole different ballgame, I think. This is the real deal, and I actually like these guys a lot, these ladies a lot.
Yeah, I like them. The blonde one said in her intro that she liked cake, although that wasn't reflected in her figure. They are
good. They know how to use guns.
Yes, they do. So beyond objectifying them, is there anything else we want to say?
Yeah, actually, you know, I think they're going to certainly do well as a team. I think they're going to be a fairly cohesive unit. I think they're going to be able to keep calm for the most part, which I think is pretty a big deal. And this is, you know, I don't think we saw much of them this episode, really, to speak of.
Right. We didn't see much of them, but what we saw was quite encouraging. They seemed pretty smart, pretty with it, you know. Definitely threats to win, for sure.
Yeah, and I think on paper, they're definitely one of the threats to win.
Okay, so moving on to Kerry and Stacey. Now, I hated these two. When they predictably were finishing near the bottom, I was hoping they'd be the first ones gone, because I couldn't stand them.
That's interesting. You know, there were several couples, like I said before, when I'm watching a season of The Amazing Race, it's kind of like watching a season of American Idol for me, where I'm genuinely rooting for, like, the most competent teams to continue, kind of like coach's philosophy on Survivor. I want the strongest teams still around, so it's the most suspenseful race for me, and so it's the highest competition and the best quality television. And this is one of the couples that I said, I'm not a huge fan. Again, I don't think we saw much of them. We certainly didn't see them performing overly well together. I don't have high hopes for them. And they're one of the teams that I'm kind of hoping we see go soon, just so the, like I said, so the actual real race can get started.
Right. I didn't, like, dislike them for a while. They just seemed a little annoying. Like, they weren't really doing much that was interesting. What really soured me on them was when, I think it was Stacey, and she had to jump out of the helicopter talking about her kids. It's like, oh, I'm doing this to my children, like, I'm going to show them that you can't give up. Like, no, what her children are going to take away from this is that if you encounter something difficult in life, you should sit around and whine about it for a bit, and then come up with some overly sentimental excuse for the cameras to justify doing it. It's like, I don't know. We said before, like, we hate it when people talk about their kids on TV.
Mm.
I'm fine with it to a point, but no, not with these two. Not a fan at all.
Yeah, I think the arrow's generally pointing down in terms of... I just don't think they're going to be around for long. I don't know. I think they're going to be gone soon, and I'm pretty okay with that.
Yeah, I there's nothing really... Like, they don't really seem to bring anything to the show, might be. And that's why we don't have anything much to say about them. So
yeah, let's move on.
Moving on then. Vanessa and Ralph, what do we think about these two?
Sure. These two were, first of all, these two certainly get the backstory of the year award in terms of he was married, she was stalking him, then she got married, and he started stalking her, and then she got divorced. And now they're dating. These two struck me. I could see them going out next, and I could see them doing very, very well. I think they're going to be a very high variance couple.
Cool.
And I say that not because I don't. I think they certainly seem to have decent enough chemistry together, and they seem physically competent. I don't know how well they're going to handle high pressure situations, and I think they're like some other places where they may encounter something a challenge that just neither of them is that. Suited for.
Right. I mean, I think they're going to be the team that has the big blow-up of the season, where something goes wrong for them, they start fighting, and it just gets completely...
More than Brendan and Rachel.
Oh, I actually completely forgot about that. I think Brendan and Rachel will have competition in that regard.
Okay. That's high praise in terms of blow-ups, in terms of your couple potential for a blow-up, if it's on the level of Brendan and Rachel.
Right.
They were. I don't even remember what started it, but on the last season of Big Brother, Rachel burst out into tears and started crying in the bushes and tried to convince Brendan that she wasn't worth marrying or whatever, just because some small competition hadn't gone her way.
Right. Yeah. I'm remiss. I completely forgot about those two. So
it's okay.
At least they'll be shooting for second place.
Yeah. You know. I like I said, I don't know. If they, their title of dating divorcees, it seems a lot better, more interesting to me as a viewer. I thought they were at first a divorced couple who was now reconciled and dating once again. And in that situation, I think they would certainly be much higher on my list in terms of potential blow-ups. In this situation, I think the guy, super jacked up, I think he had a full arm sleeve of tattoos. They seem very kind of Jersey-ish as well. I'm not sure where they're actually from. They may be Chicago for all I know. yeah, I can definitely see the potential there, but I think in terms of for a blow-up. But I could also see them being kind of the dark horses that end up working well together and everyone underestimates them because just based on what they look like.
It's possible. I mean, I'm not convinced based on the first episode, but again, maybe we see something better from them next week. Moving on then, what do we think about Elliot and Andrew?
These guys are interesting to me. On paper they probably should be. I don't know if they should be the front runners, but they should certainly be near the top of the pack quite often. And this team more so than maybe any of the others. I've voiced a concern for a couple of the other teams about encountering some kind of detour that neither of them is particularly good at. And I think just because these two, we see one's a professional athlete and the other's a singer or something, but they both seem to be in very, very good shape. They're twins. I think they're going to get along very well. They've presumably spent their entire life getting along very well. They're certainly well within the realm of possibilities as the winning team to me. But I think they may lack the versatility required just given the wide spectrum of challenges they're going to have to do if they stay on the race the entire time.
Yeah, I'm not sure how old they are. It's possible that their lack of life experience, if you like, gets them into trouble somehow. But yeah, other than that, they do seem poised to make a deep run, I think. I can't remember how highly they finished exactly.
I have it. They got sixth place.
Okay. So, a fine finish, I guess. Nothing incredible, but again, it's only one leg. We can't really... It's a small sample size to make judgments on.
Yeah, plus they do have, I believe there's now a rule that each person in the pair needs to do roughly the same number of roadblocks.
Yeah.
Yeah, if most of them are better suited to the guy with long hair, just shave his head and he can play it off like they're alternating.
Yeah, well, there is a serious point to be made there, actually, because with some of these teams, you can imagine one person being substantially better at the challenges than another. Than the other person. With these two, they seem on a fairly equal footing in that regard. Now, it's possible that they're equally bad, but I think it's more likely that they'll be equally good.
Yeah, they both seem to definitely have... I'm not concerned about either in terms of endurance, which I think is a very underrated aspect of the Amazing Race, and which is why I have Brendan and Rachel so high on my list, because they have that for sure, just based on what we've seen in two seasons of Big Brother. Yeah, these two... I actually have pretty high hopes, and I actually really like them. We didn't see much of them, but I do have high hopes, and I think they're definitely going to, or not obviously not definitely, but I think they've got a very good shot to be around for the long haul, and probably I think they're going to be one of the finalists.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think about Rachel and Dave? Now, these two, every season of The Amazing Race, there seem to be at least one, you know, couple whose relationship. You can't imagine how it started to begin with, because they always keep fighting. And I think these two are going to be that couple this season.
Oh, wow. I had these two as my front runners to win it all. I thought these two were the most cohesive unit. I think no one can hang with them physically. In terms, obviously, Elliot and Andrew can lift more weight combined than Rachel and Dave can, but I think they have that. They're a very well-balanced team. You know, he's apparently a combat pilot. And she's an army wife. She appears to be in fine physical shape. Obviously he is. I think these two are going to be they're my front runners, honestly.
What's interesting is that these fighting couples always seem to make a deep run. You think of, like Jeremy and Sandy, Nick and Vicky.
Yeah. Jonathan and Victoria, I remember.
Going back, yeah. I'm not sure why it is. They seem to be able to go deep. They don't seem to win that often, but I can see them being around until, you know, just before the finale.
If I can make a very old-school Amazing Race reference, Terry and Ian. I don't know. Terry and Ian. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them. It was an older couple, and this guy was kind of just like this drill sergeant with his wife, and she would just keep doing every, they were probably around 50 years old, and they actually got ridiculous results despite being at a substantial physical disadvantage. They were on All-Stars 2, I think. All Stars as well. I'm not sure which version of All Stars. I assume the first one. They were on one of the early seasons.
Right.
So, I mean, a fun callback for anyone who remembers them. They were a lot of fun to watch. So Rachel and Dave. So you think they're going to be the couple that blows up?
Well, not blows up. I think it's just going to be a constant undercurrent of, there's going to be tension between them, because it always seems to be the case that the guy is fairly tactless about how he asks his partner to do something, and then she's overly sensitive about it and yells at him, and, you know, this becomes a recurring pattern.
Now, I feel the need once again to remind you that Brendan and Rachel are also on this season.
Yes, quite, although...
Yeah, so that's interesting. I thought you would have Rachel and Dave, I think just because of Dave, honestly, and Rachel seems very willing to... this may just be playing into sexist stereotypes or whatever. I honestly think she's very willing to, she's eager to please, very committed to the team, and I have no problem putting them at the top of my list. And I'm honestly surprised you don't have them there.
Well, it seems if you take the positive and the negative aspects of Rachel and Dave and magnify them, you get Brendan and Rachel. So
that's true.
Yeah, I think Brendan and Rachel, for those reasons, are higher variance pick. But I think they're the better pick overall.
Oh, wow. I kind of take issue with that. I think Rachel Riley, Rachel from Big Brother, it's going to be kind of a who's on first situation here in terms of their both females being named Rachel. I think Rachel from Big Brother is a much more competent performer I have more confidence in saying she can hang with the rest of these couples. But I honestly think Brendan is I think Dave completely outclasses Brendan in every aspect.
I was going to say, actually, both the Rachel seem to dislike each other already, and I was wondering how much of that is because they're both named Rachel, and they're, like, competing for the same territory or something.
That's a good question.
The editor seemed to be making play of that as well, because whenever one Rachel did something, the next scene would be of the other Rachel, like, doing the same thing in a completely different way. And I know that the blonde Rachel, like, made fun of Rachel Riley at some point.
I meant to bring this up earlier when we were talking more specifically about Rachel. I don't know if you're aware of this. Nobody comes between Rachel and her $1 million.
This is true. I hope we get callbacks to Big Brother from Rachel this season. What about Art and JJ then? These guys are the Border Patrol agents that Brendan apparently got offended by.
That's right. Art and JJ, they had a very strong showing. They were the third place team this time. And they certainly seemed to work well together for the most part as a team. That said, I think they're going to kind of fall back to earth. I don't think they're going to stay in the front of the pack. I think they're going to be another one of those middle of the pack finish teams.
Yeah, sure. I like them. They seem like nice guys. Again, they weren't featured very heavily, as I remember. I like how they form this, like, government wage slave alliance with Rachel and Dave, and presumably Neri and Jamie as well.
Mostly, yeah, that's actually interesting. They are all federal government employees. Yeah, what'd you think about them?
Again, there's not really much to say. I think, you know, decent showing. They're probably going to finish in, like, 4th to 7th range, I think. I don't think they'll be one of the first teams out, but. Yeah, watch next week and see them get eliminated first, because we never get things right.
Yeah, I was thinking that when we were talking about Carrie and Stacey about how they're gonna, like, you know, they're gonna go soon, and I'm not gonna be sad about it. Like, they're gonna go on to win now, and we're gonna look like idiots or the clowns or something. The clowns are gonna have some heroic comeback,
yeah,
some underdog rally to take the whole thing down.
Right. So our last team is our first boots, Misa and Maya.
Mm.
What do we make of these two? I was quite sad to see them go, actually.
I was as well. I was very disappointed. Yeah, they. Oh man, I really liked these guys, and I thought they would do better for a little while. Maybe a bit of a disadvantage having the first challenge be so driving oriented.
Just at the same time.
Yeah, I know. That, you know, you, like you said, you couldn't, but I actually think the thing we obviously need to talk about with regard to these two is that ending where they were, you know, probably about 100 yards away from Phil and just completely missed it. What do you think happened there?
Oh, that was brilliant. For those of you who didn't remember, like, so they rush into the garden where Phil's waiting, completely failed to notice him, run, and then they start running around the grounds looking for him. And in the meantime, the next to last teams who were, the Greedos managed to find Phil. Like, they come into the building and find Phil and, like, pin him to the post by a matter of seconds.
Yeah, that was, it's like, what, if you're the Guido team and you see the two Asian, Misa and Maya, take off from the empanada station before you, and you know that you just need to run around the grounds to find Phil, you're like, oh wow, that's it, that's game over for us, this is embarrassing, yeah. We just got last place. Yeah, that's brutal.
It was a fitting conclusion to that amazing race experience, I think.
Yeah, it very much was.
They were shown just, like, failing at everything.
Yeah, that was not a very good winner edit for those two.
Well, quite.
Not optimistic about their chances to win.
I think it was one of those two, I'm not sure which one, because they both look the same, who delivered the best line of the episode, which was, my uterus is in my throat. Which, I don't even know what to make of that. Like, what would possibly, like, spur someone to saying that?
I thought the shot of them, the shot looking over Phil's shoulder of them approaching the mat, as if the camera's panning ready to get a shot of them running towards Phil, and then they just start taking off the other way. And Phil does this little, like, raised eyebrow trick, and it's like, oh, where are they going?
That was great. It was the first time I've ever actually seen contempt on Phil. I think it's Phil Cohen. First time I've ever seen contempt on Phil's face. It's like, because usually, you know, he laughs at one of the teams with this kind of wry smile, raised eyebrows. Like, but he just seemed utterly, he disliked them, I could tell.
Can we talk about Phil for a minute? Because I really, really like Phil as a host.
Yeah, I like Phil too.
I think he is fantastic. I think he is perfect for this job. I think there's a certain level of kind of tongue-in-cheekness that goes along with a lot of it, and I think he pulls it off fantastically. And I think he's also very good at being at delivering bad news to the eliminated teams.
Oh, definitely. A lot of people who dislike Jeff Hope actually say they want him to be more like Phil. And to me, I think there's a clear difference between the role of the host in the two shows. Like, in Survivor, there is a role for the host to to be more active, to be editorial, if you like.
Whereas, he's host and moderator.
Yeah, whereas with The Amazing Race, like, his job is just to report information and to narrate, and I think Phil does that very well.
I really like Phil.
Yeah, he makes it look easy, I think.
Yeah, I think he definitely does.
Let's talk about the race itself a minute, so, like, the places they went to, stuff like that.
Sure.
What did you think of the course?
The course, you know, I know they always start in America, and typically, I think, go from there right to South America, and that may just be me having a bad memory. Maybe it's picked randomly. The course itself, first of all, if we're going to talk about the challenges specifically. I love the bait and switch on the skydive. I think, from what I understand in the thread, they never really mix it up. Pretty much every clue historically has been, they tell you directly what's going to happen. And you get to knowingly pick which person's doing what. And I guess that bait and switch was kind of a first. And I like that. And I would have been really mad because I would have wanted to do the skydiving, and I would have insisted to my partner that I get to be the one who does it. And then get burned by the clue.
Oh yeah, for sure. What do you make of them going to Argentina? Because the part of Argentina they went to, they made it look like a third world country, like Bulgaria or something.
Yeah, it's interesting. Argentina, you know, I've never been to Argentina. I've heard great things about Argentina. I've seen it, I believe, on previous seasons of The Amazing Race. And I always, with Argentina, bottom line is you make a good point. They do, you know, of course they can only show certain bits and pieces of each country. I like the way, I think The Amazing Race works so, as well as it does, because it's kind of that, it's also a travel show as well as a game show and a reality show. And you can see all the different aspects of these different countries that they get to go to, and it's a different place each week. Argentina, I feel like they could have done a lot more in terms of, they had them skydive into kind of a desert, and then they had them go to this small little village and make empanadas or whatever. And I may have been, I really enjoyed the premiere, and I'm excited to keep watching it. What specifically about Argentina were you interested in discussing?
Oh, no, I just wondered what you thought, because I think the course itself is one of the more interesting parts of the race, because the best episodes are usually the ones where, you know, they have a good backdrop for what's going on. And I think one of the things that kind of let the episode down in that regard was that, Argentina, or the part that they went to at least, didn't seem that exciting.
Yeah, you make a good point. I'm sure there's much more they could be doing in Argentina. But you know, I'm sure they plan out all the legs of the race well in advance, and hopefully we're gonna get to see some more lavish parts of some different places.
Oh, sure. It seems like a lot of the time the place itself feeds into the race, if that makes sense. Because so let's say, you know, they have to fly to Denmark, and then one of the tasks is to do this traditional Danish dance or whatever. And here it's like, well, they had to make a kind of pastry dish. It didn't really resonate with me, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose empanadas are apparently all the rage down in Argentina. But you know, the thing is, I'm not European. I'm an ignorant American, and I don't really have this kind of global view that I get the feeling you do. And so there's at least that to take into consideration. Where they are for the episode is just a name to me. We don't really think about other countries in terms of what they mean as a country. They're just places on maps that aren't the U.S.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me watching the episode was, if you're, you know how with each task they have a person who delivers the clue when they're done? So like, they have to call the person over and they assess how well they did the task or whatever. If you're in a non-English speaking country and you're the officiator for task, you have a tremendous opportunity to just troll the shit out of all the people. You can just sit there and like decline them for as long as you want, based on some technicality or whatever, and just watch them get more and more irate at you and at themselves.
Yes, sorry for talking over you. Yeah, you really, that one woman seemed to be judge, jury, and executioner with regard to, she could just sit and make Brenchel wait all day.
Right, it's probably like the most power she's ever enjoyed in her life, just getting the chance to frustrate the hell out of some ignorant Americans or whatever.
Yeah, I thought she was funny, the empanada Nazi, I thought she was a funny little character. She got more screen time than most of the teams.
Right, yeah. I don't know.
I'm going to miss her. Get her on The Amazing Race. anything else to add?
No, that about does it for me, actually. I'm not sure if this is going to become a regular segment. I think there's more to work with this week because it's the premiere and we've just been introduced to all the team and stuff. But if there's enough interest in the episode itself, who's interesting enough, then we might make this a common thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's always the chance that Brendan and Rachel are going to get eliminated in two episodes and I'm just going to lose interest. But hopefully that's not the case. If you guys like it, we'll definitely keep doing it. The show is fantastic. It's won, like, every single Emmy for Outstanding Reality TV Show. Jeff Probst has won every single time for Best Host up until maybe this last year. The Amazing Race is really, in terms of critical acclaim, just completely destroyed all the other shows.
Right, yeah, and you could argue there's good reason for that, because even though it's fairly formulaic, it puts up good ratings as far as I'm aware, and it's a good show. Like, the formula works, which is why they keep sticking to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also an interesting thing, because it gets absolutely massive ratings, and it has the lead, its lead in is 60 minutes, I believe, which is typically a show watched by, an older demographic than typically watches reality TV, but I think they get a ton of carryover for, I think, more than both Survivor and certainly more than Big Brother, older people would really enjoy the show. And I think it's a show that everyone will really enjoy. And the formula, yes, it's formulaic, but it's formulaic because it works. And that's why we're on season 20.
Right. It seems like Survivor and to a lesser extent Big Brother have kind of become insular now, where the only people who are diehard fans of it are people who have been watching for a long time. And as ratings have declined, the people who are still watching tend to be the diehard fans who watch fairly often. And one reason for that might be that it's difficult to really get into the show if you haven't been watching for a while, so it's a kind of self-fulfilling thing. Whereas with The Amazing Race, you can just tune in, and the basic premise of the show is pretty simple. Like, these teams are racing against each other in a foreign place.
Yeah, and even more than that, you can tune into one episode, and it will stand alone. There's a start, middle, and end to every single episode. Every episode's a leg, and you can sit and watch one episode and still have... It's just a microcosm of the entire season.
Right, like, with Survivor, if you miss two episodes or something, you can come back and find that there's been a tribe swap and some new alliances formed, and you don't know why people got voted out or whatever. Whereas with The Amazing Race, you know, none of that is true. You can just tune in and enjoy it.
Yeah, with shows like Survivor with Big Brother, it's when you know what's going on, I would say they're more interesting shows, obviously strategically, but more interesting shows in general. But The Amazing Race, there's certainly merit to anyone being able to tune in.
Right, and I think that's a natural thing, where when a show becomes targeted to a more niche audience, it can work on appealing to that niche. And I think a good example of this is Community, actually, where the show has a lot of diehard fans who get all the in-jokes, who like its brand of humour. But if you're tuning in for the first time, a lot of that might just fly over your head, whereas it wouldn't if you're watching a show like Parks and Rec or whatever.
Oh, Parks and Rec, there's still plenty of
Give me an example of a show then, so that I can...
Like Two and a Half Men, something where it's very obvious and straightforward.
Because I was using Parks and Rec as an example because I've never watched it before. I was just guessing.
Yeah, I'm telling you, you're making such a big... When we talked to Jim Rice, I asked him what else he was watching on TV, and he said Parks and Rec, the best show on Thursdays. Which is wrong. The best show on Thursdays is The League, but it's not on Thursdays anymore right now. So tune into Parks and Rec. Tune into Survivor on Wednesday. Tune into The Amazing Race on Sunday. And keep tuning in here. I think that's it. Anything else to add today?
Nice segue, by the way. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. Subscribe to us on iTunes. For those of you who don't know, on the blog page, you're probably doing it right now, streaming these episodes, but we would love it if you would subscribe on iTunes.
Just to go over our plan for the next few weeks, really, we're working on getting some guests in the mold of, We enjoyed interviewing Jim last season. We're hoping to be able to do that with some other former contestants. So far, all of our appeals have kind of fallen through, but we're working on it. We're setting up some guests, and hopefully that should come to fruition pretty soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very optimistic about that, by the way. I don't know why Dom phrased it so negatively. I think that's it for this week. So thank you again for listening. We will see you next week.